You're listening to a feed of the Association of Music Podcasting at musicpodcasting.org.
In 2009, Erk went to the dark side and became a music podcaster. He discovered a wide, wide selection of music. Apart from Dozy Do by Julie the Band, it's now 2010 and Erk comes down the pipe and into your ears. Bigger, stronger and faster. Every Friday, it's Erk FM time. Now here's your host of Erk FM from Channel Erk, here's Erk.
G'day, I'm Erk, and welcome to episode 127 of Erk FM. It's a very crowded studio here at Channel Erk, and it's a very, very excellent guest that we have on the line, an Australian legend in rock and roll. Firstly, we'll talk about who we've got in the studio. G'day to my mum, Judy, who is the host of Blast from the Past and Judy's Blast FM. G'day.
G'day.
How are you going?
Great.
Are you excited?
Very excited.
And we normally don't have a studio audience, but we do have a studio audience today. Half of Foundry Road, we have Explain and we have Brad. Hi, guys.
Hey, guys.
Hello.
And on the line from Victoria at the moment, we've caught him just before he's going overseas, we have Australian rock legend Dave Evans. G'day, Dave.
Hi, Erk. How you doing, Judy and boys?
How does it feel to be called an Australian rock legend? Is that worthy? Do you feel excited when you hear someone call you that?
Yeah, I remember the first time I was called that. It must have been a few years ago now. It sort of caught me by surprise back then, maybe about 10 years ago, I guess. But, without saying a big head or anything like that, I'm just sort of used to it now, I guess.
Awesome. So why don't we go right back to the start? It's a while ago. You're a veteran on the scene.
A virgin.
I think it's been a while. I think it's been a while since that's happened.
Way back, you said he would have been.
Well, it depends what we're talking about, virgin wise here.
Singer.
Okay. How did you lose your virginity, music wise, Dave?
Well, back in Wales, where I was born, actually, before I came out to Australia, I was singing way back then. My father, my family, they're all really good singers. As you know, it's a tradition in Wales to sing. Eisteddfod is a Welsh word, and we always sang. When I came out to Australia, I sang at all the school concerts, and my father was on stage here, so singing was just a part of my life, since I can remember.
Awesome. And so when did you come out to Australia?
I was 5 years old when I came out here, but I remember way back till I was about 2 years old, I suppose. I got a very good memory back in Wales, and we emigrated to North Queensland originally, up to Townsville, and we sort of moved west to Charters Towers, one-horse town kind of thing, but by the time I was 16, I was down in Sydney.
And so talk a little bit about what it was like to be getting into music way back then and how it's changed compared to the modern day.
Well, I suppose it's got into music really because I had a big argument with my father when I was 16, left home and went down to Sydney. I was 16 years old, living in King's Cross and all that kind of stuff. And I got a job, worked and that kind of thing. And I wasn't in a band at that stage. I went back up to Charters Towers just for a little bit. While I was up there, I was asked to join a band because I've known around the town as, singing and all the jukeboxes and stuff like that. So I was pretty young. I didn't have sort of a career at that stage in front of me. So I joined the band up there and that started it all off. And by the time I was like 17, 18 like that, I moved down to Sydney and got serious about it. But back in those days, there was just so much live music around. There was that many venues all over, that many bands. If you were good enough, you could be an early spot at one venue then taking off and doing a late spot at another venue. So the competition was fierce because if you were serious and you wanted to record, there wasn't that many labels around that were recording bands. So to be the chosen few, you really had to compete with all the other bands around as far as your songs are concerned and your musicianship. So on the one hand, it was great because of all the venues. You could play quite a lot of venues. But if you wanted to step up and be a recording band, it was a lot harder, but worth it if you got there, for the few of us that got there at that time.
Can I ask a question?
Of course.
Back in the when you first started in your virgin years, did you guys ever play at the Royal Easter Show?
No. I was in different bands in Sydney before I got with the boys and formed AC/DC. I was with another band called Velvet Underground for a while. They were one of the top 40 bands in Sydney and surrounding districts and that kind of stuff. But with AC/DC, once we got going and had our record out, you know, Can I Sing to You Girl and a film clip and that kind of stuff, some of the, you know, our very first gig was Checkers Nightclub in Sydney, which was one of the top spots. We were so lucky enough to get that as our first gig. But we did a few smaller ones as well around the place, of course. But also, with our tour, Australian tour there, for Can I Sing to You Girl, we started off at the Sydney Opera House. And, you know, we did Horden Pavilion Festival Hall down here. So we were doing some pretty major shows, you know.
I remember the Horden Pavilion days.
Yeah, absolutely. Great.
I've actually got one of your albums that you bought out. I can't remember what the songs are on it, but I've still got it in the cupboard, an old vinyl from back in the old days.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be worth a bit of money now, I'd say. Big collectors. I might auction it off.
Well, yeah, I know the single Can I Sit Next to You Girl with Rock and the Parlor on the B-side can sell.
Yes, I played that the other day. You had it up on your Facebook page, and I actually sent it to Explain to have a bit of a stir with him.
Well, it can sell for up to $1,000 US at times.
Yeah?
Just that single.
Wow.
So, Dave, for our listeners who aren't aware, tell us the start of the AC/DC story, because some of our listeners overseas might not be aware. Big name here in Australia, but not necessarily to everywhere where our listeners are listening.
I'd been with Velvet Underground, as I said, and We split up because we used to back Ted Murray, who's passed away now.
He was great.
He wanted to form a band because he was a solo artist. And he asked the other guys, a couple of the guys, to join him. He had a big career happening. So we split up, not no animosity, and they joined Ted and became the Ted Murray Gang. But while I was with Velvet Underground, I heard about a former guitarist who'd been with them called Malcolm Young, who was a brother of the famous George Young from Easy Beats. After the band split up, I answered an ad in the Sydney Morning Herald for rock singer and all that kind of stuff. It was Malcolm Young who put the ad in there, and he'd heard of me through keeping in touch with the Velvet Underground boys, and he said, "Hey, I've got together with a bass player and a drummer, come over and have a jam," which I did, and we shook hands and formed a band, no name, and then a week later, Malcolm asked if his younger brother Angus could also audition because his band Kentucky had split up. Angus came over and auditioned for us, and he joined as well. So that's how the band got together. And the name, we were tossing around different names, trying to think of a good name, and nobody could agree with anything. But at one of the rehearsals, because we had a show coming up at Checkers, that was our first gig coming up, New Year's Eve there, and Malcolm and Angus did mention that their Sandra, their sister-in-law, came up with a name to see if we'd like it, called AC/DC, which meant, alternate current, direct current. And it was on the side of a lot of different appliances all over the place. So it was free advertising if we wanted to use it. And we thought it was an easy name to remember and free advertising. So we went, we'll go with it. And that's how the name came around. And we did our first show at Checkers Nightclub.
But don't you get more Akadaka?
Sorry?
Don't you get called more Akadaka?
Yeah, people say Akadaka. No, we don't. We never did. It was AC/DC. And people call it Akadaka, and that's just a nickname for the band. It doesn't matter what they call you as long as they come to the shows and buy your records.
That's right.
So you're coming up for your first gig as AC/DC, Checkers Nightclub, New Year's Eve, no pressure or anything. what are you expecting? You know, you're looking back, you're just about to go on stage. What are you expecting?
I'd never played at Checkers before. I'd been there, of course, like everybody else, trying to get into the place. It was always packed. It wasn't a very big venue. I was very excited. I was with Angus and Malcolm Young, younger brothers of George Young from the famous Easy Beats. Colin Burgess was on drums, who was from the Masters Apprentices, mm-hmm. which is Now, he was famous.
Geez, you're dropping some names now, man.
Yeah, absolutely. And Larry Van Creet was on bass. He was sort of unknown, really, like myself, really. So it was very exciting to be playing the main stage there to bring in New Year's Eve too. We were the top spot. They usually had three or four different bands there at Checkers as well. So not only was it our first gig, but we had the top spot. We didn't really have enough songs for the two sets that we had to play. So Malcolm asked me to write some names of some songs down, and he was just going to play some riff. And he said, just make them up as we go along. So we had enough. We had about 12 songs or something like that, and I wrote another 8 names down. And all we did was we wanted to fill in. I'd go, this is a song called Midnight Rockin' or something like that. And Malcolm would just start a riff, and the rest of the band would just come in and watch his chords, and then I'd just make up a song on the spot. And that's how we did the first night. Half the songs we made up on the spot because we could do it, if you know what I mean. The other songs were ones that we learnt. So we winged it, but the place went crazy. And it was New Year's Eve; they were all drunk anyway, and we just went wild. And it was a fantastic start, to the band.
And so, how, again, mainly for the benefit of our overseas listeners, how did AC/DC progress in the early years?
Well, when I was with the band, we were lucky enough that George Young, the older brother, and Harry Vander, who'd also been with the Easy Beats, had just got a position with Albert's Music as the A&R guys for the new label they were launching, Albert's Music label. And, of course, they just done an album with Stevie Wright, just about to release that, Hard Road, and they signed us up. Which is nice. It's who you know half the time rather than what you know. with what you know, actually. So we were lucky enough to record a record fairly much straight away, about 3 months, I suppose, after we got together. And it was released not long after Stevie Wright's album and the famous Evie, Part 1, 2 and 3, which was massive. Cast Next Jiggle was released and was racing up the charts all over the country, top 5 in some places. And so when we did the Opera House gig to start off the tour with us and Stevie Wright and also Lou Reed from America, from the Velvet Underground, the American Velvet Underground, our record was happening. Stevie was number one all over the country, and it was a great launch for our record, Class Next Year Girl.
Talk to us about the Sydney Opera House. It's not usually known, and I'm presuming way back then, not necessarily known for hard rock / metal performances. It's got more of a conservative name.
Well, I think this was the first rock act they had there, and there was I think it was Hatched by Alberts. They just hired the place and announced to the whole of Sydney that there was a free concert there for rock, and the place went crazy. And it was packed, of course. The whole place was packed. There's about 8,000-10,000 people or something outside. He just couldn't get in. Mm-hmm. It was great. It was a great genius, stroke of genius there for amazing publicity. The Opera House with rock inside it, and it was so exciting. And I'd never been inside it before, and to be on the main stage of the Sydney Opera House was, I'll never forget it as long as I live. And I don't think anybody that was there would ever forget it either. It was an amazing start to the launch of the single and the tour, to promote the single. It was a very, very special show, that's for sure.
Now, of course, we have to remember that this is way back in the 70s, and we don't have all of the conveniences that we have now, for instance, with the internet. So how did you spread the word? Radio would have been very important back then compared to now.
Newspaper.
Yeah, well, radio was. Everybody listened to, the number one rock show in each city, it wasn't Triple M back in those days. That came out a little bit later, but 2SM was the big radio station back then, and to get airplay on 2SM and the affiliates, that was what everybody tried to do, but they had a tight rotation. So it was radio. Everybody listened to radio. There was the magazines, the rock magazines that were out. There was the Go Set from the 60s and, of course, Ram afterwards, and And of course, we also did the film clip, Can I Sit Next to You Girl, which was filmed at the last picture show venue down in Cronulla, which we all used to play. And it was only a TV show called GTK back in those days. It was a 10-minute segment only, GTK, Get to Know, it was called. And if you were lucky enough to get on GTK, that was on the ABC, that was national. That was before Countdown, which we were lucky enough to get on GTK as well. So, you know, it sort of happened for us pretty quickly. Overnight, we were sort of known nationally and we had a hit record. You know, it was just a pretty amazing time. Really.
Now, when you started with the band, it would have been almost impossible to predict how quick it happened and what sort of heights you achieved.
Yeah, it was. Well, it was my very first experience of recording anything, and then a film clip as well, and next minute you're doing the Opera House and, you know, the Horton Pavilion and festival halls and stuff like that. It happened sort of so quickly. And, of course, you're rubbing shoulders with, you know, the top echelon of performers in Australia and the industry. My head was spinning, that's for sure. It was hard to believe that it was happening, you know. It was a pretty amazing time for a young man. It was just playing sort of small venues, really. Not bad venues, but to be thrust into that and being interviewed and all that kind of stuff, it was, it's hard to describe it, yeah.
If 2010 Dave Evans could talk to early 1970s, mid-1970s Dave Evans, what would he say? What advice would he have for young Dave with all your experience that you have now?
Now he's getting a bit below the bell, isn't he, Dave?
It's a bit hard. It's hard to speak to a very young man about being mature and that kind of stuff. especially when you're having the time of your life at the time as well. You know, you're just having the absolute time of your life. Just say, look, you know, just be mindful of other people's egos. You know what I mean? Be more understanding of other people and don't go too overboard and have too good a time while others may not be having as good a time.
And don't get a big head.
As you. It wasn't a matter of having a big head, really. It was just a matter of having such a bloody great time, especially with the ladies. a few of the others in the band weren't doing...
These guys here, mate, I might have to get a big stick and start standing in the audience batting these girls back, I think.
And no, don't do that. that's the sort of thing. It was just be mindful and be a bit more gracious about that kind of thing, you know. Be good to the roadies, which I learned early in the piece. Be good, very good to the roadies and appreciate what they do, the sound guys and the lighting guys and all that kind of stuff. And I learned that the hard way when I was with Rabbit and that kind of thing. I remember having to go to apologise, cap in hand, to the roadies and that kind of stuff for being a big head and all that kind of stuff. And I learnt what they did and realised that without them, no matter how good you are on stage, they can make you sound like shit.
Exactly.
And they can put on a bad light show and all that kind of stuff. And how important they are. And I learnt that. And no matter where I'm touring or anywhere around the world, I always find the lighting guy and the sound guy and meet them, introduce myself to them and that kind of stuff, and they really appreciate that, you know.
And the main thing is to have a good time.
Sorry?
Have a good time.
Oh, yeah, I love what I do. I have a great time, but make sure that everybody else around you is having a good time as well, you know. Once the hard work's done, I mean, the rehearsals, it's got to be absolutely perfect because I'm one of those people who is a perfectionist. It has to be absolutely spot on. Everything has to be absolutely spot on. That's not just the music side of things, but the theatrical side of things as well. Mm-hmm. Once you've got that, all the hard work is done, and it is hard work, that's when you have your fun. That's when you really have fun. Yeah.
And not only that, if the audience see you're having a good time up there, they're going to have a good time too.
They will, and the thing is also a bit of advice. You've got to give the audience everything you've got. So they've got to see that you're giving them something. You're giving you can't just be up there going, look at me, look at me. You give the audience everything. You just take, no inhibitions. And if they know that you're working your butt off up there and giving your all to them, they will then reciprocate and give back to you. It's give and then you take.
So you're out there, you're having a great time with AC/DC, and it came to an end. I don't know how much you want to talk about that, but it came to an end.
Mm-hmm. Yep, it came to an end. As I say, it was all good at first, and we were all sort of having a great time. But we had personnel changes as well. By the time I split with the band, we had our third bass player, our third drummer, our third manager, personalities were not gelling. They just were not. The original band, I loved that. Colin Burgess was a great guy. Still is a great guy. Larry was great, and other members. Noel Taylor was in the band. Neil Smith, we all got on great. But with different personnel coming and going at a quick rate, there was a lot of tension, a lot of friction and that kind of stuff. So when I split with the band, I actually split with the band in Adelaide after a fight with the manager. A physical altercation there, and I left the band, and we had to go to Perth for our record was number 5, I think, in the charts over there. We had all the gigs to do and all that kind of stuff, and so when we all sobered up the next morning after the big blue, we decided to press on with the tour from Adelaide, and we had to come back to Adelaide from Perth and had some shows in Melbourne. We were only halfway through the tour, well, two-thirds of the way through the tour, I suppose, and to keep our powder dry until the last show of that tour and then have a meeting, which we did, but it was very, very... The shows were fantastic and the people loved us and all that kind of stuff. It was amazing. But in our private times, we didn't really talk. It was pretty icy, and it's very hard when you're away from home and your friends and you're sort of living with people and you're not getting on. By the time the meeting happened in Melbourne, the last show, I was with two friends that afternoon down at St Kilda Pier. They were begging me not to split from the band, and I'm going, I can't take it any longer. I can't handle this animosity. When they go, but the band is so good, and the band was great. We had a hit record and all that sort of stuff. But after the last show, we had a meeting, and before I could say anything anyway, Malcolm just said, "That's it, Dave, you're out." And I went, "Fine." And the other two guys, the bass player and drummer, who were bitching about a lot of things, Malcolm just turned to them and said, "You got any problems, you guys?" And they went, no. All of a sudden, they didn't have any problems. Anyway, it didn't do them any good because they got sacked shortly afterwards anyway once they got replacements. So at least I left with some dignity, which was cruel by me.
So you've moved on. How did you follow up? Did you take a break or did you go straight into other projects straight after?
It wasn't too much of a break later because I sort of found out that all the backslappers and people that loved me, once I split from the band, all of a sudden most of them didn't want to talk to me anymore and that kind of stuff. I thought, okay, when you're hot, you're hot. When you're not, sort of thing, So I learned a lesson there too that all the people, a lot of people you thought were your friends, right, all of a sudden weren't your friends, were they, because you weren't hot anymore. So about 3 months later, I suppose, I was down at Checkers having a drink down there and bumped into Ted Murray. And Ted said, "Hey, you're looking for a band?" And I said, "Yeah." And he mentioned a band called Rabbit in Newcastle, and I'd seen them in Checkers. They were a great rock band, hadn't recorded or anything like that, and their singer was leaving, and so I got in touch with them and went up to Newcastle, actually from Sydney, joined them, and they had a lot of material and that. And it wasn't long after that that we signed a deal with CBS Records, and it was all on again. And it was great because the other boys were just wild guys, the wild boys from Rabbit, and it was fantastic to get back in the studio and do our first album and get on Countdown and all that kind of stuff and get around Australia and do some Australian tours and things. So that was very, very enjoyable, and we were all mates, which was great. We still are to this day, which makes it so much easier when you're working together, living together, touring together. If you're all mates, it's fantastic, so that was great.
Did you have the feeling of here we go again?
Yeah, but I was a little bit. I had a lot more. I say a little more wiser, this time round, which I was able to share with the other guys from Rabbit too. I was able to talk to them about the industry and being up that next level because they had to attain it at that time, which we did, of course. But yeah, I gave them my experience, which they listened to and that kind of thing, and I had both eyes wide open the next time around, you know what I mean? And I was a lot more serious about the industry side of it and business side of things the second time round, because you can't buy experience, you've got to learn from it, you know. So, yeah.
And that's often with a lot of things in life. You do things for the first time, you might be really good straight out of the bat, and you prove that with ACDC. But then again, you go around the second time and you've learnt from things that have happened, and you know, you've all got a bit wiser. And you know, that happens a lot of times in life in general, not just about music.
It does. It happens with relationships and things like that as well. You know, if you go back to, you know, girlfriends and that kind of thing and whatever, and even just with mates, you know, you have your falling out. It's called maturity and just experience that happens right throughout your life. You know, hopefully you do learn from it. You know, if you keep making the same mistake time and time again, then you're an idiot, aren't you?
Yeah. So let's fast forward a bit. How did Rabbit end up? You're with them for a while?
You know, sold records overseas throughout Europe, Japan, and all that kind of thing, which is really good. But about 1977, 78, I guess, disco hit really big with the Bee Gees changing their style to disco Saturday Night Fever. A lot of venues closed down. They just put DJs in there. We still had the same area to cover, and Australia's a big place, you know. We still had the same expenses, big trucks and, you know, big stage acts and roadies and accommodation, like I stuff, but only half the venues to pay for it. And a lot of us with the big shows, we just went bust, like Sherbet, Rabbit, Hush. ACDC by this stage was overseas. They were living in the UK at that time. But a lot of us just split because we couldn't afford to keep going, you know. And then other bands who had bands at that time, like the Angels and Cold Chisel, who hadn't recorded, they weren't used to, you know, big production, that kind of stuff, and they were able to keep going. And they then got signed, of course. They were the next wave coming up, kind of thing. With some great albums, of course. They were the next lot that came through after us. It was just a matter of attrition at that stage, you know. Disco just knocked out that many venues, and top venues, big venues, you know. There's a lot of little pubs to play at, which is hard for us to do when you're doing the Horden Pavilion and festival halls and bigger gigs, you know what I mean? And to say, hey, we've got this pub in Redfern to play. So you go, yeah, well, I don't know. Of course, the money wasn't there either. So it just happened like that. At that time, so we were actually, the gigs that we were doing, we were pulling record crowds. At that time, we had a new single out called Let Me just before we broke up. We're on Countdown with it, and the crowds at the venues were bigger, but there were not as many venues, so it just didn't work out, you know.
Now, apart from anything else, Dave, if you're a survivor, you survived through the 70s, the 80s, the 90s. Sounds a bit like a radio station, doesn't it? The 2000s, and now it's 2010. Is there any time where you just thought, you know, I've had enough of music, I'm going to walk away and, you know, get a day job and all of that sort of thing?
Yeah, in the 90s, I suppose. I put out another album when I was living in Melbourne, Dave Evans and Thunder Down Under, which had the cream of Australian rock on the album, fantastic players. I also brought out Mark Dernley from England, who worked with Ace Frehley from Kiss and had worked with AC/DC as well, great producer. With a record label called Reaction Records, only a small label kind of thing, like Mushroom started years before. But they went broke, bust up, just as I had my single being played on 3XY here in Melbourne, film clip was being played on MTV, and that just busted that up. That was so, so disappointing after all the work I put into that album and the great players, and it was a quality album. And just getting airplay in that. I went back to Sydney, actually, and got into advertising through the 90s, which was good. It helped me, you know, as far as marketing and that kind of stuff's concerned. And, you know, I made pretty good money, too, out of the advertising industry. And I used to do guest spots and stuff with different bands up there from time to time. But it's just something that just eats away at you, you know. And I suppose 2000, 2001... I got back into it again, and you know, that's it's like an actor. Once you're an actor, this is acting too, of course. But if it's in your blood, the grease paint's in your blood, you know, what do you do? You know.
Do you ever get upcoming young bands that you think are going to be good and help them?
Not really. I'm too busy doing what I'm doing, you know what I mean? If somebody asks me something, well, support band, ask me, you know, whatever, I'll be, you know, give them some advice if they need it, but I'm pretty candid about things and don't overwhelm them or don't get too egotistical about anything. You just sort of give them just sound basic advice, and that's it, really. People always ask me, do you like my music? It's very hard music is your own taste. There's nothing right or wrong in music. It's like art. If you like the painting, then it's good. If you don't like it, then it's crap, you know. One man's, you know, poison is another man's, you know, steak and eggs. It's hard, you know. I just encourage people to keep going, and even if I don't particularly like their music, personally, so what? There's plenty of bands and artists that I don't like that are megastars, if you know what I mean. I always encourage bands that are you know, out there doing the hard slog and who are dedicated. I mean, we're all sort of soldiers of rock and roll, if you know what I mean. And that's why I didn't mind helping out with the Bon Scott concerts over there to help in Fremantle. Well, they flew me out from Texas to do those here to help raise money for the statue because, you know, Bon's another fallen soldier of rock and roll, like so many others. And all the experiences that he had, I eventually went through them because he was a lot older than me, of course, when he joined the band. We all go through stuff, you know, either together or even apart, but we, you know, it should be a camaraderie, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So do you think that it was easier for you when you were starting in the business compared to like guys that we've got behind us, Foundry Road, in the modern day? Which do you think is easier?
Well, I think, you know, each era or whatever has its good points and bad points. As I said, way back then, there were a lot of gigs, so you really got to hone your craft because you were playing a lot, you know. But there was less record labels, you know what I mean? Now, anybody can have a label. You can record yourself in your bedroom. Everybody can do it and put out a CD. It doesn't matter anymore. But you got a chance to actually do some recording, I suppose, and get it out there somehow. I don't know. I take my chances back then because at least you've got a lot of gigs and you do hone your craft and you get a lot more than now. You know, a lot of people playing in garages rather than out there playing lots and lots of gigs. Back then, I suppose, it was a better era in that sense.
So let's fast forward and talk about what is Dave Evans doing right now in the modern day?
Well, I just released an album not long ago called Judgment Day, which is a follow-up to my previous album, Sinner. It's just released in the UK. It's been released in Europe, of course. And I've been performing in Europe and the US. I've been living in Dallas, Texas for the last four and a half years. But I've just done a UK tour promoting Judgment Day, the album over there, which is really fantastic. The reviews were, you know, 5-star of the performances and the album, which was really great. Seeing as it was new music, you know what I mean, from Australia. Even though I was living in Texas, I was writing stuff there and I recorded it here in Australia, though, with my boys up there in Newcastle. I'm here at the moment rehearsing for a show in Noumea in New Caledonia there in the Pacific, along with Angry Anderson and Doc Neeson from the Angels. We're doing that show there. I'm talking to the boys that were in the Aussie Badasses. I did the Australian tour last year as well, but doing some shows here in Australia in the new year. So I've already got one show booked at the Cherry Bar in ACDC Lane in Melbourne here on Australia Day Eve. So we'll be rocking in Australia Day at the ACDC Lane there, the Cherry Bar. So I'm looking forward to that and talking to people at the moment overseas about going over and touring again overseas, of course. So
I think now's a great time to feature a song because we've been talking with you for a while, but no one's actually heard you yet. why don't we feature a song, and I think rather appropriate actually, Tell us a bit about Sold My Soul to Rock and Roll.
I guess it's a bit of a warning, really. Sold My Soul to Rock and Roll. I mean, everybody wants to be, you know, in a rock band and be bad and all that kind of stuff. But there's a price to pay. And that's what this song's all about, really.
So here is Dave Evans, Sold My Soul to Rock and Roll.
Some people like to settle down, spend their lives in a sleepy town. Some people like to play it safe, 9-to-5ers who are never late. I met a man with a fancy car. He said, "Why you walk a boy? Get in my car. I'll send you singing and playing guitar. Sign up with me and you'll be a star." Sold my soul to rock and roll. Sold my soul to rock and roll. But when I die, I'm going straight to hell. Don't know what they're living for. I'm getting paid the wages of sin, and all I gotta do is play and sing. Got a contract that ties me in. My time options, I'll be cashing in. Sold my soul to rock and roll. Sold my soul to rock and roll. When I die, I'm going straight to hell. Sold my soul to rock and roll. I got money, I got fame, I paid the price, now I'm you want.
You're listening to IRC FM, episode 127. We've Judy in the studio. We've half of Foundry Road, and also Dave Evans. And this is where I talk a little bit about the meat and the potatoes sort of things in relation to the industry. I always like to ask these musical nerdy sort of questions. How do you come up? How do you get inspired by music
to write songs? You mean?
Yeah.
I just sort of take things from real life, really. Most of the songs, just about all the songs really that I've written over the years are personal, if you know what I mean. They may not be exactly the event that happened kind of thing, but you get ideas. I get ideas from real life, and that's when you can put the passion into it and make it real. So, yeah, just experiences, I suppose. I mean, listen to the Beatles way back then. Those songs that were so incredible to us, they were really personal experiences. Like, you know, Abbey Road, you know, that's where they recorded the album Strawberry Fields. I've been to Strawberry Fields there in Liverpool. And that's where John Lennon used to play as a kid and stuff like that. So you know, Penny Lane. I've been to Penny Lane. That's where they used to catch the bus and stuff like that. So it's you know, whether it's a love song or whatever, it's you know, if you can draw from real life, you can really mean it when you're playing it or singing it. You know what I mean? You can really get that across to the audience. Because don't forget, the experience that you're having in your life, so is millions of other people. So don't be frightened to get your, you know, your story out there, because people can relate to your story, though they like you, you know. It's cool.
So you mentioned a few places that were significant for the Beatles, and you've been there. If someone wanted to go on a Dave Evans tour, where would they go?
Texas. Gee, all over the world. Well, I'd have to go to Carmarthen, where I was born, in Wales, and you know, see the, you know, where I was born, and the ruins of the castle is right in the middle of the town there, and places like Llansteffan in on the South Wales coast, the ruins of the castles there, and they'd have to go to places like Charters Towers in northwest Queensland, and see a different way of life out that way, the outback, and then of course Sydney and the Opera House and King's Cross, where I moved when I was 16 and so lived there. And, you know, it's a pretty tough part of the world to get to survive, if you know what I mean, and thrive if you can. Yes, Melbourne. I've spent my time here as well. Dallas, Texas. You know, Munich. It's sort of hard to pin me down. People say, "Where's your hometown?" It's like, gee, it's hard to say. It's wherever I am at the moment, I guess. You know, I've had so many different hometowns, from Carmarthen to Charters Towers to Sydney to Melbourne to Dallas to, you know, whatever. It's been hard to pin me down, I guess. I mean, I love Melbourne, you know, I love Sydney, and, you know, I love Dallas and whatever. I love New York, and I've never lived there. I've been there. It's one of those things.
How does 1970s King's Cross compare to 2010 King's Cross? And I'll bring Judy on in this as well.
Very lame, isn't it, Dave?
Well, in 1970s, there were a lot of hippies still living there from the late 60s, you've got to remember, you know, and it was a real difference. There was, of course, the prostitutes and the drug addicts and the criminals that were there, but there were a lot of hippies and people that, you know, flowers and flower love and that kind of thing. Is a great contrast to live there, as long as you kept your nose clean.
What about the old drag queens?
The drag queens were there as well, and real mixture of people. But there, as I said, there were a lot of long-haired hippies and girls there, free love as well. So from the undercurrent of the danger and the violence and all that kind of stuff that was around, there was, of course, the culture of love, peace, and all that kind of stuff. So it was an amazing place to be at that particular time. It was an incredible place, actually.
I remember us girls, I had Noel F. B. Holden, and we used to head up the cross on a Friday night if there was nothing going out here in the West. And we used to drive around. At that time, it was Vietnam era. And all the Americans, and they'd come into port and head up to all the clubs there looking for chicky babes.
Yeah, I used to see the American soldiers there and speak to them as well. I was pretty young. When I was 16, 17, I'd speak to the Americans, and they'd sort of tell me, you know, their thoughts about the war and that kind of stuff, which was not a war anyway. War was never declared.
No.
At all. It was a police action, and that's what pissed them off, because they didn't mind going over there if they're going to win.
Yeah.
Just to do a round of, you know, tour of duty and get shot at and that sort of stuff, they went, it's not worth dying for.
Exactly.
And that opened my eyes too, because I thought, wow, you know, because I didn't know what was going on over there. There was that aspect as well, talking to the American boys.
I remember us girls used to go in there, and the girls could get into the clubs for nothing, because that was a way of getting the guys to come in and spend their money.
Surprise, surprise.
It was great, because we get pissed for nothing.
Well, of course. That's how it worked. But, you know, as I said, I was too young to drink anyway. You had to be 21 to drink back in those days.
No, we put our age up. No. I pinched my sister's card.
I know that, but I'm just saying. Just saying, I got into clubs too, of course, but I didn't drink, because the thing was also that culture where we came from, we all left home, the whole generation left home, all over the world at that time. And so to a lot of us that left home and saw violence at home with alcohol and stuff like that, none of us drank. In fact, we hated alcohol.
Yeah.
We used to call them juice freaks, people that got drunk, because that's where the violence was. Other people, there's a lot of drugs, of course, in King's Cross and around the place, and you know, people that got stoned weren't running around bashing each other. They were too stoned to get up off their chair. And even people that were taking LSD and that kind of thing, they're too busy exploring the, you know, the hell's going on with my hand? It's turned into a flower bush.
And the old fountain, they used to have the old gay bashes.
They used to do that.
That was bad.
We never worried about that sort of thing. We were very tolerant. I mean, that's the reason why we left home, because of the intolerance that was at home. But unfortunately, these days, a lot of those people back in those days are now in charge of councils and government, and they've gone 180 degrees the other way. Now they want to regulate us, tell us what we're going to eat, what our kids are going to eat, what we're going to do, just walking down the bloody street. And these are the same people, right, who were hippies who said freedom for everybody. They've become absolute hypocrites, and I can't stand most of the councillors and people in government around my age who are now trying to regulate us, tell us what to wear, what to eat and that kind of stuff, when back then they were advocating complete freedom.
Exactly.
And so, you know, it makes me sick to see them.
So walking through King's Cross 2010, Dave, must seem like a very alien place to you compared to the good old days.
I don't do it, mate.
There you go. It'd be quite an hour, wouldn't it?
I don't go there anymore. You know, it's just, what's there for me now?
That's right.
There's nothing there for me, mate.
What do you say? Been there, done that, don't need to do it again.
In the T-shirt.
Yeah.
Because there was a lot of places to play, too, in King's Cross. There was a lot of venues and things as well. The Cross was full of musos. We all lived there. You know what I mean? We lived at the Cross. So when you'd go out the other day, you'd be bumping into all the musicians, drummers, guitarists. We all lived there.
Yeah.
At the Cross. We disseminated. After that, we moved out to Bondi and the eastern suburbs. You know, they got rid of us out of King's Cross. The council put up spikes along where we used to sit and stuff like that, so you couldn't sit there, couldn't even the village there at King's Cross. All the places where we used to sit around, they put spikes up and stuff like that, and they just made it uncomfortable for us. So we all moved out to Bondi and other Coogee and other eastern suburbs areas. So that aspect of King's Cross, the musicians and they sort of got rid of it. So it's completely different now.
Yeah.
Tell us a story you were telling us before we went on air about Woolmaloo and some people being unable to pronounce it. That was very funny.
Oh, yeah. When I was in Wales, where I'm from, Turdover and stuff, some of my cousins actually just wanted to know whether I could still pronounce Welsh. And they wrote some words down, you know, I got Fanashley and that little place in Anglesey.
Oh, I love it.
So no probs, and so I wrote down Woolloomooloo for them. I've got W-double-O-double-L-double-O-M-double-O-L-double-O, and I wrote it down and said, say that. That's an Aussie place, and they couldn't. They go, Woolloomooloola-moola-moola. I said, Woolloomooloo. So I trumped them.
Did you ever go down to Harry's Pie and Peas at Woolloomooloo?
Of course.
We used to all finish up there.
Yeah, in fact, they're in Newcastle too. When I did the Australian tour last year, we were in Newcastle and down by the waterfront there. And the friend said, oh, do you want a Harry's Pie? I said, what do you mean? In Sydney? They said, no, they're here too. So we went up and had a Harry's Pie and Peas, which is great, in Newcastle.
You ever been
there? Yeah. So let's talk about the mechanics of songwriting again. When it comes down to writing a song, and I know I asked the guys from Foundry Road this question, what comes first for you, the music or the words?
Well, for me, it's usually the hook line and the melody. Because the thing is with my music, they're all very, very strong hook lines, as you'll see with bands like AC/DC, bands like Roast Tattoo, The Angels, that kind of stuff from our era. The hook lines are really, really strong. and you've got to think, can I hear the audience singing that when I'm playing it? And if you say, yep, you can hear them sing, "Soul, My Soul," the rock and roll or whatever it is, or, you know, yep, I can hear them, the whole crowd absolutely singing that. So they're great. So once I get the lyrics and the melody, then I think, now how am I going to justify the chorus? What's the story about? And then you think, okay, well, why did I think of that in the first place? And you've got to then, what I do is I then write the lyrics, not any old lyrics. They've got to be pertinent to the chorus, and that justifies the chorus, tells the story. That's why the chorus is there. And then because you've got the melody already, you've got the melody and the lyrics, that's the song to start with. Every song is the melody and the lyrics. You don't need any music, really, for a song to be a song. You can sing a cappella. You just sing the song, and that's the song. If you want to sing Danny Boy, you don't need the music. Oh, Danny Boy. So that's the song. But of course, you need that riff. You need that really happening riff there. So once you've got the got all that happening, then you think, well, what's let's put the riff in, the great rock riff to go with it. And that's the formula, and it's the formula for, you know, AC/DC, Rose Tattoo, and us and the Angels. As I say, these bands, it's a great formula with the great lead break in the middle, and the great hook line chorus, and the great riff, and just, you know, great drum, solid drums, and that's that particular sound. But I mean, you look at any song. You look at you go back to the 50s. You know, if you want to, got all the songs. They've got a great hook line. Everybody sings the hook line. Everyone remembers the hook line. Don McLean, you know, drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry. Good old boy, everybody knows that. Everyone knows it.
Ever want to see your face again?
Yeah, that's right, same thing. You know, TNT, you know, whatever it is, you know what I mean?
Dynamite. I know that one.
Yeah, well, that's right, but it goes back to the Beatles too, you know. I mean, and the Rolling Stones, you know, they've got that hook line. Everybody knows it.
So where do you get your hook line from?
I don't know. It just happens.
Are you in any particular place when you write your song?
No, it just happens when it happens. Usually if I'm in a songwriting mode, yeah, then I'll put my mind to it and just let it flow. It's hard to just go, I'm going to write a song, bang, and write it. You just start humming and just, you know, you're subconscious. You might be doing something else and you're singing, and all of a sudden something will happen and you go, that's pretty cool.
What about if Judy's
laughing because she knows what I want to ask and she wants to ask it first.
What if you're in bed at 3 o'clock in the morning and you wake up and you've got a song in your mind? What do you do?
I'm glad you brought that up.
Do you get up and write it, or do you have a bit of paper next to your bed, or these days people use their phones?
I do now. When I was on tour, you know, in the past, back in the 70s, that kind of thing, I'd wake up in the middle of the night with this great song and go, that's fantastic. And then I go back to sleep, wake up in the morning and go, what the hell was that? And I could never remember it so diligently. On tour, I used to put, believe it or not, paper and pen beside the bed. It didn't happen every night, of course, but I'd wake up and go with a song and go, my God, that's great. And I'd write it down, right? And then happily go back to sleep because I didn't care. I wake up the next morning and go, what was that? And I go and look at it, right? And, you know, 9 times out of 10, I threw it away. Anyway, not that bloody good. I thought it would be. But I kept some of them, and, in fact, I recorded a couple with Rabbit on the Too Much Rock and Roll album that I woke up with. So, yeah, if you have inspiration, write it down because you will forget it. You will forget it. So write it down, the lyrics and the melody, that kind of stuff. And it's there. But if you have inspirations during your sleep, like I have, make sure that when you're on tour or whatever, that you diligently put that pen and paper next to you, because if you don't write it down, you will forget it.
So 2011, Dave, looking forward, big year coming up.
Well, you know, you hope every year's a big year. I mean, I'm going to be doing some shows here in Australia, putting the Aussie badasses together. But looking forward to getting back overseas. I'm not sure yet. I'm talking to people in Europe at the moment. I know some people, you know, my friends back in the US want me to go back there as well. But, you know, they say it depends on, you know, what comes first, you know, and the shows. You've got to get have the bookings and that kind of thing. But I always get itchy feet. I hate staying in one place for too long. I guess I've been travelling since I was a little kid, you know, even coming out to Australia when I was a little boy. I've travelled all over Australia and stuff, and it's hard to settle down. It's just, and, you know, wherever there's an audience that want to rock and go to your music, you go to the sound of the guns, as they say, mate.
Awesome. Well, Dave Evans, you absolutely rock. We'll finish with a track of yours. I think Sinner is very, very appropriate. Thanks, mate. Thanks, mate, for your time.
Thanks, Eric. That's great. No worries. And Judy and the boys.
Cheers, Dave.
Our pleasure.
So where's the best place for people to find you online?
My MySpace is, you know, pretty much up to date. It's, of course, myspace.com/ Dave Evans Rocks. My website, of course, is DaveEvansRocks.com. And even Facebook these days is Facebook.com/ Dave Evans Rocks. So I answer my mail too, so that's cool.
Yes, he does. I vouch for that. Are you going to write up on Facebook when you're overseas so we can follow you?
Yeah, of course. I used to use MySpace a lot, but I'm not really enamored with MySpace these days. I don't use it a lot. I just screwed it up something terribly. It's so hard to use and et cetera, et cetera. I hope they do fix MySpace. It's a good website, you know, but to use it for networking, it's not as good as it used to be, you know, back in the past. Facebook, you tend to sort of, you know, get chat with your friends and get stuff out there, but I check them all.
Awesome, Dave. So thank you very much. And he is Dave Evans. He certainly does rock. Having a sort of a Wayne and a Garth moment from Wayne's World, the whole We're Not Worthy thing. You remember that scene, Dave, where they met Alice Cooper? Uh-huh.
Of course, of course.
We got to get going.
No, no, no. Stick around. Hang out with us.
Cool. Yeah, we'll stay and hang around with you. With Alice Cooper.
We're not worthy! We're not worthy! We're not worthy! We're scum! We suck!
So here's Dave Evans with Sinner, and we will see you next time on IRC FM.
I just want to say to everybody out there, just keep it rock.
Yeah! Get in early.
Awesome. Thanks, Dave.
Cheers.
One's too many, but's not enough. Can't help myself, man, I love the stuff. One's too many, can't give it up. I want to be a sinner! It's the age-old story of Adam and Eve. Red snakes and ladders in the apple tree. A tiny little taste is all I need. Such a fine line between pleasure and pain. I never can decide, so I do it again. One's too many, but it's not enough. Can't help myself, man, I love the stuff. One's too many, can't give it up. I wanna be a sinner. Razor's edge, living ice skating on a mirror. I've been drinking with a driver on a runaway train. I'm heading off the rails and I kinda like it. When you're caught between the devil and the deep blue sea, take him by the hand and go swimming.
Once, two, three, but it's not enough. Can't help myself, man, I love the stuff. Once, two, three, can't give it up. I wanna be a sinner. Pleasure and pain, I never can decide, so I'll do it again. Caught between the devil and the deep blue sea, take him by the hand and go swimming. One's too many, but's not enough. Can't help myself, man, I love the stuff. One's too many, can't give it up. I wanna be a sinner. One's too many, but's not enough. Can't help myself, man, I love the stuff. One's too many, can't give it up.
You have been listening to a Channel IRC production. Channel IRC and all five podcasts are licensed under a Creative Commons non-commercial, non-derivative, share-alike license registered in Australia. Music is used with direct permission or under agreements with various music providers. All rights to the music contained within remains with the original rights holder. Some sound effects are sourced from the Free Sound Project under Creative Commons. For more information about Channel IRC, go to www.channelirc.com.